It is 27 and a half minutes after 9 o'clock here in the Central Time Zone of the U.S., and we're joined by Dr. Don Clark. Don, a member of the board of Creation Moments, also a terrific Old Testament teacher well, at least part of it. Do you teach other books? We've talked about Daniel. We've talked about Genesis, certainly. And now we're every other week or so we're working in the parables, but that's New Testament stuff. Are there parables in the Old Testament?
Not parables.
Not by Jesus. Yeah, there's poetry.
Proverbs. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And poetry and the Psalms and those. But you could say that. Well, okay, some of the prophecy is certain. Hidden, it not necessarily is something that you can read. Some of them are pretty straightforward.
So prophets either didn't know about parables or had no interest in them.
Well, Jesus was the one who taught in parables.
Well, he did, but that was a common rabbinical technique that the people in first century Israel knew when they were hearing a parable. And because it was an oral culture, they listened and retained what was said. I don't know that kind of an audience was available during Old Testament times. I just don't know.
People are the same.
It was still an oral culture, yeah.
Yeah, that they would have remembered a story better than here, just memorize this, wrote Chronicles, for example. We're doing the men's Bible study, and we're going through First Chronicles at the moment, and we trudged our way through the first 9 chapters of First Chronicles, and it's just name after name, and this guy began that guy.
Well, consider a campfire of people who, itinerant, move around, and they tell stories, and they related the Genesis story from one generation to the next, and apparently didn't use parables. I mean, this is history.
It was taught as history and taught as, passing down from generation to generation. When your children ask you, where did we come from? You can tell them, well, this is how the world was created. Mm-hmm. And it's unfortunate that, we're not doing that so much anymore. I mean, teaching our kids, if we teach our kids from the very beginning, we call them Bible stories. And there are many, many illustrated young children's books now that parents can use to teach the Bible stories. And the kids eat them up get them off of the phones and all of this other stuff. And just go and teach the Bible stories because they're great stories. I mean, the Samson and Noah and the flood and all of these, Joseph and the multicolored coat and why it was his coat multicolored. And, you could get into great discussions just by talking about some of these great Bible stories.
Instead of coloring pictures, which is what a lot of church/daycare centers have turned to. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so there's, I think we need to get back to teaching the basics, certainly to our kids and unfortunately to adults, because we have now a whole generation of adults that don't know
the Bible. They have no clue.
When I first became a Christian, I was listening. I was out in California at the time, and I was listening to pretty much every Bible teacher that was on the radio, plus, reading my Bible, and I was soaking it up this is Genesis, for example. That was the first book that I started reading Genesis, and I'm reading Genesis 1, and I'm saying this is the only way it could possibly happen. But that was only after I became saved. So the Lord had to take the scales off my eyes. So
that's a good way to put it. I was surfing the net. Sharon has a question. I'll get back in just a second. I was actually looking for a football game, and I found Ever Increasing Faith Ministries, which I used to watch in the 80s and 90s when I lived in California. In the 70s, Dr. Fred Price was the pastor, and he was one of the best straight Bible teachers I've ever heard. It was a delight now, 50 years later. Now, they're old videos. I'm not sure that he's still around and still teaching, but it was a delight to see that on TV. I don't know that you get that with newer programs anymore. Those that I've come across, I've been basically not interested in.
Well, yeah,
but the core teaching is critical.
A lot of these current programs are, it falls in the health, wealth, prosperity type teaching,
prosperity,
because
gospel
people are more interested. I think there are a lot more really solid teaching programs online, which, you know, not necessarily the best thing to glue yourself to a computer screen or your phone, but I mean, they are out there. You just have to know where to look for them.
Exactly.
And you have to filter them through your biblical worldview. All the way back, one point I was going to make, talking about Bible stories for children, a lot of times I avoid the word story just because it feels like fairy tale type story. And I know it's a semantic thing. When you talk about the biblical account, it reads more like, well, not that we can trust newspapers if we use newspapers. The other thing about parables, it takes the everyday stuff, which I suppose the ancient Hebrews also drew from that context of everyday life. But the more senses you involve in recounting the story, the better it's going to stick. If you're using visuals, auditory, even sometimes tactile stuff, that's why people used to use flannel graphs and things, where you could actually touch something and it helps your memory. So the more, I think even as, I don't want to say old people, older adults, if we I'm looking at our people who don't know, we're doing this by teams, so we have video of each other, and we're all very platinum blonde, but it to involve the senses really helps our memory, even with mnemonic devices. But we have to be really careful, because now there are people putting out children's Bibles that are totally eradicating sin from the vocabulary. There are these books, and it's like, God is a God of love. We can't talk about him being angry. So again, as a parent, you need to be aware, and you need to be discerning, which, you know, the Bible says we're to be discerning no matter what.
Now, this brings to mind Dr. Don's theory of devolution to me, because we're talking about Old Testaments and how information was communicated across generations. Mm-hmm. I think there was an emphasis on accuracy. While there may have been some creativity involved, in other words, I want to tell this story in a more interesting way than I heard it when I was a child, but I'm not going to misrepresent the facts. I think that was a concern, which brings me to the scientific record. How's that for a segue, huh?
Oh, boy.
Thank you.
Wow.
I was wondering how we would get back to where we were supposed to be going.
Well, I think we were smarter.
We have a topic for today.
We were smarter way back then, and we trusted and retained what we heard. But now it's written and rewritten and altered so subtly in a thousand ways over the generations that the original meaning is often lost. The same is true for science. Now, we're talking about a supergiant amphipod is what they call it. So you think this thing is huge. It lives down to 3 to 6 miles deep in the ocean, but it's about a foot long. And scientists thought it was rare forever. It was first described in 1899. It was first seen, but it's been around a lot longer than that. But now they've discovered with new technology and the ability to search the depths, that the old assumptions were wrong, that this thing is flourishing, and it's all over the floors of the ocean over much of the world right now. And so the real question is, when will we have it in our deli departments, Don?
Well,
foot-long shrimp. Imagine that.
Yeah. Yeah, they're not really shrimp, but they're called Alicella gigantica, and a group out of Australia wanted to find out, you know, how prevalent these creatures were. And so he started exploring the ocean floor. Now, we have different types of equipment than we did years past, that we could go down deeper. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, when we do that, and they had high definition video cameras and stuff, they find out that mm-hmm. these things are not rare at all as they were originally thought, because they couldn't go down as deep, I guess, and didn't search in various places on the ocean floor. And they find these things all over the place. It's like, gee, over 60% of the ocean floor has these creatures. And the most important fact in their study was, so I guess they took some samples of these creatures and then did the DNA analysis to say, okay, certainly there's got to be a lot of diversity in these various animals that we picked up from various locations, whether it be in the Atlantic or the Pacific or, you know, around Australia. There's got mm-hmm. to be some diversity. And lo and behold, there was none.
Mm-hmm.
They said that, okay, this is one species, and it's all over the earth. And they were stumped by that.
It didn't fit the so-called settled science, which is never really settled, is it?
No, it shouldn't be settled. But of course, you know, when it comes to evolution, evolution is a fact. They invented yet another term called evolution stability. I guess what they're referring to, if your environment is constant, then you don't evolve or something like that. I don't know. But instead of looking at the facts and saying, hey, you know what, these creatures are fully formed, fully developed, not changing. We think over millions and millions of years, how is this possible? It should have evolved, but it didn't evolve, so we'll just call it evolutionary stability. And
that's an interesting term, and it's horribly misleading. I mean, it's a self-contradiction, an internal contradiction, you know?
Well, they won't give up the term evolution. No matter how much data, you know, we acquire as in our scientific knowledge, they won't admit the fact that, you know what, maybe these creatures were designed, developed, and, put in that environment because that's their environment that God created them to live in. And they do their best in that environment. And that environment wasn't disrupted very much by the flood. And so, yes, the waters on top of the ocean were tossing and turning, and we had gigantic tsunamis, and it estimated that to one point that the tsunamis could be as high as 800 feet. Now, a tsunami 80 feet is considered really big. So can you imagine what 800 feet would do to the coastline and further inland as well? But all of that activity that was going on the surface wouldn't disturb these animals very much. Obviously, if the crust is breaking up at the same time as we think it was, so to produce the continents that we have today.
Well, with respect to depth, the article says that the Gigantia, they had to rename that for one thing. It should be just like jumbo shrimp, you know, present and thriving in the abyssal, which is the layer 3,000 to 6,000 meters. Now there's 1,609 meters in a mile. I looked that up. So we're looking at it down to 3 miles deep. And then there's the Hadal, H-A-D-A-L, 6,000 to 11,000 meters. They're in that zone too, in the Pacific, Atlantic, and Indian Oceans all around the world.
So they're very deep. I mean, it's
and deep. And how do these scientists explain the ability of these animals to live with the pressures of that depth of water?
That's pretty amazing too. Yeah.
Yeah. And you would think that if you brought one of these creatures to the surface, that it would just, you know, completely dissolve because
right.
they kind of classify them as in the crustacean. And normally we would think of a shrimp or a crab, mm-hmm. you know, something like that with a hard shell and everything. But these have to be pretty flexible creatures. And as you say, in order to survive in that pressure. Now, the only way you can survive in that pressure is that your internal pressure equals the external pressure.
Mm-hmm. Right?
So they must have some mechanism for equilibrating the pressure on the inside and the outside. Otherwise, they would be crushed. And they're obviously not crushed from the pictures that are in the article that they provided. That's another, you know, God creates animals to live in certain environments. And
by the way, if you're curious to see these things, I put the link to the Newsweek article in the chat window at brokenroadradio.com. Incidentally, Sharon and Donna, we've got a comment from Ron, who's a good friend of the station. He says, Dr. Don is right on. We need to start. This is talking about our conversation at the beginning here. Mm-hmm. We need to start teaching about the beginning and in particular, the fall and the eternal plan of redemption. Then he thanks us and thanks Sharon. That's guys and Sharon, he said. So you got name mentioned, Sharon.
There we go. Well, the whole point, there's a missionary group called New Tribes Mission who teaches the Bible and the accounts of history in a chronological fashion, you know, so that they understand what the beginning was and how people developed and how they continually would turn their backs on God and he would bring them back. But the whole thing about these creatures is, how can you deny that there was some intelligent design that created a creature that could live at that depth?
Well, and that's a point I'd like to make now. You really can't if you're an honest scientist or if you're honest just period. Mm-hmm. And the same technique is found in science, in politics, in sociology, in economics, in everything that humans touch, this idea of evolutionary stability. If the facts don't fit your theory, alter the language.
Change the facts.
Yes. Well, yeah. And they certainly altered the language here because, you know, they say it. After doing the DNA studies, they said suggesting a single species with the capacity of extreme dispersal, enabling by both evolutionist stability and geological factors, such as shifting ocean currents and various other things, tectonic events over millions of years.
Hmm.
So they're baffled because they got their time frame wrong. I mean, we would expect, you know, a creature that is living in it. Yes, okay. Like I said, there's the ocean floor probably did experience some upheaval during the flood, but certainly not anything like on the top of the surface. And so there was some greater stability, you know, down there. And the other thing is that the environment wouldn't have changed, you know, too much from pre-flood to post-flood down at those depths, like it did on the surface. I mean, on the surface, you know, we know from Genesis, I mean, you know, we know from the history book that the conditions on Earth before the flood were very good. And even after the fall, they were still very good. And things didn't change until post-flood. I mean, or at the time of the flood when God said, you know, I'm going to wipe out all the living creatures on the face of the earth, a man in particular. And so we had a drastic environmental change, if you will, catastrophic, one would say, global catastrophe on the surface of the Earth. But we wouldn't have had that down at the depths of the ocean. And so the diversity that we see on the surface, my point in all of this short discussion here, my point is that the diversity, we see more diversity on the surface of the Earth than we do down in the depths of the ocean because of different environments that were created post-flood.
Now, that was that's kind of an assumption in a way, though, because I'm thinking of these animals that deep, there can't be the variety down there, the potential for interbreeding and so forth, which would affect the evolutionist view of things. If are they all alone down there? We only see a picture of them in this photo, but there are other deep sea creatures, really weird fish swimming around down there. Yeah,
right. And if you bring them up, they kind of get squished. But there are other creatures that live at those depths. This happened to be.
Well, there's got to be a food source, and it's got to be organic. So it's either plant or animal, one of the two.
Right, and it could be decayed plant material that settles down. To the bottom. God created all kinds of creatures, including bacteria and slime and stuff, to live in various environments. And even the harshest environments, you would think, okay, nothing could live here, like volcanic vent, for example. Mm-hmm. In the depths of the ocean, but yet we still find creatures, bacteria, algae, that thrive in the environment because instead of using oxygen, they were using sulfur as their oxidizing reduction agent. We're so used to oxygen because that's our system for life, but they use sulfur. So God, he's got a sense of humor and he creates these things I think, baffle man during this time when science seems to want to say that it is God.
Every now and then, God needs a good laugh, I just think
yes, indeed.
I think so. And the question remains, if these things are so plentiful, how long before they're at $6.99 a dozen in the supermarket?
Well, they're probably going to be pretty expensive because they're pretty far down.
You got to need a lot of line to hook one of those things. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Don, I want to thank you for what you bring to us, your expertise and just the whole faith side of these discussions is so important to people, and we appreciate that too. And look forward to next week. Don, again, is the vice chair. Never to be the chair, but the vice chair of Creation Moments. Their website, creationmoments.com. It's a great reservoir, an archive, a library of scientific information that deals primarily with the biblical story of creation. It teaches you, and it teaches you how to teach it, and could be of great use to you in your Bible studies and personal studies as well. Creationmoments.com. We recommend the visit. And Don, we'll see you in a week or so, okay?
Okay. Sounds good. Thanks. You folks have a great week.
You too. Bye-bye.
You too.